Good day to our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a global collection of musicians. I'm Jim Hutchings, and today I'm joined by Anne Livingston. And Anne is the former executive director of the Vancouver Area Drug Use Network. She is a street-level expert in harm reduction and HIV/AIDS strategies. And I'll say right at the outset that the reason that she's here is she is going to be delivering the Woodrow Lloyd Lecture. Actually, by the time you hear this, she will have delivered the Woodrow Lloyd Lecture. And we're very pleased to have you here, Anne.
Thank you.
And I see also that more recently you've become a vocal critic of the impact of tough-on-crime legislation on the lives of marginalized people, and you're knowledgeable about the Canadian prison system and about links between incarceration and public health, public drug health issues. Mm-hmm. And wow, let's keep on going here. You're also involved in COPWATCH, an organization that does citizen surveillance of the police. You co-founded the Pivot Legal Society, which works with street people. You're a former supervisor of Insight, a safe injection site in BC, one of the appellants in the Supreme Court decision that upheld the Insight safe injection site. And you frequently speak out on key issues, including missing women's inquiry. And I'll stop at that point. And again, welcome. And I'm just wondering, basically, how you got started in this whole thing.
I come from a family of, activists, but my mother was quite active when I was quite small in going to, looking around in a community that she lived in. Mm-hmm. We lived in Kamloops and then in Victoria, and just taking action on things that she thought she could take action on in terms of, that's the most important thing, is to work with the very people, and then would also use any sort of social status or start nonprofit societies and try to keep things going for a sort of persistent resistance and mostly poverty issues. She worked with a lot of Aboriginal people, trying to organize different ventures that they had. But the most notable one was that a lot of Aboriginal people were sent to Victoria to go to the Catholic boarding school there.
Okay.
And she just showed up and said, you guys must be awfully lonely. Would you like to form a social club and have dances? And they were very happy to do that. And so anyway, it's a kind of proactive approach to community problems. That's the approach I take. And my oldest son is 31 and he has cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And a guy named John McKnight is a profound, he challenges very strongly the idea that people who are labeled, whether it's addiction or disability, that they want to have lives and they want to have control of their lives and not necessarily just be the client of someone else who's providing services to them. So that's my background.
Okay, so starting off in Kamloops, there's quite a difference between Kamloops and Hastings. Sort of how did you get from there?
Well, I left Kamloops when I was quite small, but Victoria is where I did my junior high, and I didn't make it through high school. It was a bit much. But anyway, I think that I wanted to leave Victoria, and I spent a lot of time going to university. And I think at the birth of my child with a disability was the most radicalizing experience that I had personally, that had me really clearly understand that the conditions we lived under and the services being offered just didn't jive together, and that we needed to make welfare more accessible, that we need things like social housing, and that the fabric of the community is really there in those issues. So mm-hmm. that if you're constantly struggling with trying to pay your rent, you're really not going to become an activist. And if you're taking money on the side in order to eat and your welfare rates are so low, you won't become a welfare advocate because you'll be afraid that you'll be discovered and charged with a criminal offense. Mm-hmm. So, there, you know, I really became aware of how would we, if your whole life is just a race against time about any positive thing that you can accomplish.
Right, right.
So that's how I feel about this. Landing in the downtown East Side was odd. I moved to Vancouver and was taken. I got housing at the Four Sisters Housing Co-op, which is two blocks from Main and Hastings. Mm-hmm. And it's a fairly pleasant place with a mm-hmm. playground for children and, you know, but two blocks away is Main and Hastings, which is a real drug epicenter. So we saw someone overdose in our alley, and the overdoses were just appallingly high. And I had been a childbirth activist as well as the work I did with families of children with disabilities, just becoming an activist in that field. And I kind of thought, oh, my goodness, there's, you know, 200 people a year dying of illicit drug overdose in a 10-block area, plus 100 dying of alcohol poisoning, plus 50 committing suicide. It was a tremendously difficult situation there. And I, you know, volunteer on boards, and I was on the board of the Residents Association, and then became a board member for the Needle Exchange. And we started with a group of volunteers who all of us were unemployed in the early 90s. And we put together a drop-in center for drug users that none of us were paid, and ran. It eventually became the first injection site in Vancouver that we know of, anyway. So it was using a sort of neighborly model. So people had my home number. Later on, we formed the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, and many of the drug users already knew who I was. So it was a lot easier to get going. And I think VANDU's a very radical group in that we're not going to provide a service, but we're going to create a voice for a group of people that, should they have citizenship and, you know, not have their human rights violated constantly and be treated poorly and, you know, given barriers to moving forward with their lives, would fare better. And so the biggest task, of course, is to convince the drug users of that, which you don't really convince them. You just start to act with them, and by example and mentoring, they start to see how this could work. So it's been a very long journey that VANDU started in 1998.
Wow. Yeah. So it basically started off just kind of being neighborly.
Yeah, I think that there's a, it's played, I think being neighborly now is a diagnosable mental illness. I'm serious. I wish it wasn't true.
I suppose some people think it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Dangerous behavior.
Well, I guess. Yeah. I guess. I mean, the change in my neighborhood, the downtown East Side, is profound in the sense that there were really a lot of drug addicts. There still are. Mm-hmm. And they were standing outside, and now there's more places for them to go. And things that we fought for are either, you know, we're sort of, oh, we fought for that, and now it's a problem. You know, we still have to go do a lot more. Other things, is it's just a profound change. But my children, I had a baby at 48, which is quite unusual. So I have this whole generation apart. My oldest is 30 and my youngest is 10. When my 10-year-old walks to school now, the police pick him up, and they didn't do that 14 years ago.
They pick him up, you mean?
Oh, he's walking alone. I was like, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Don't your kids walk to school? Like, so there's this kind of, I don't know, it's part of our culture now, this insanity around creating these crises and then, you know, having tons and tons of cops and all of this security and cameras. And it's a very, you know, I know what the danger is to him. It would be cars. And, you know, do you know how to cross the street safely? That's my big concern.
So the police see your son walking to school in your neighborhood, and they think that he's absolutely at risk, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So we managed to get through that, which I was happy to have the precedent set, as they said, that child walking to school is no longer a child protection matter. And I was like, that's what I wanted to hear.
Oh, okay. So you were then being
I was being investigated because that was considered abuse to let him walk to school.
Wow.
So anyway, that's just one of those kind of canary in the coal mine things about the changes we see taking place. Even though some things are very positive, other things, you know, we're just super over-policed neighborhood. The overall, though, goal is to network more widely and create a social justice movement, which has the drug laws simply removed. They're mm-hmm. absurd. They were racist in the beginning when they mm-hmm. were put in. There's no backing for any kind of logic to them. And they're creating a situation where a mass incarceration campaign, which is very racist as mm-hmm. well, is causing larger and larger numbers of people to be put in prison. So very true in the States. We know this already, mm-hmm. but we have already now public-private partnerships with a number of prisons in Canada and and they're provincial prisons. You know, people go, oh, that's Harbor. I go, no, actually, it's provincial. Mm-hmm. So we need to keep the pressure on and see which party is going to come down and say no to mass incarceration. No. Because people are going to jail for non-crimes. It starts off with mm-hmm. a ticket that they don't pay. That's a right. very, very high. I mean, they're poor already. If you can't sure. pay the fare on a bus and then you're charged $286
yeah.
for not paying the fare on a bus, I think it starts off at $176. When you don't mm-hmm. pay, it goes up. But anyway.
And that's the SkyTrain too, like yeah, if you get on the SkyTrain.
And then they put them on, they have armed transit police, not just on the SkyTrain, but they were getting on buses. So some of our members have 24 tickets. So then we'll see if you... do a lot of research, you can find these kind of groups that are getting together now to lobby the provincial government to make a law that once you owe a certain number in mm-hmm. tickets, you're simply jailed. And then they like to take out a piece of paper and show you how long someone's rap sheet is. But if mm-hmm. you look closely, you'll see that these are missing court dates, mm-hmm. Not being able to stick to probation orders, which yeah. are very, very... not that they're so draconian, they just last forever, and it's mm-hmm. a weekly appointment you need to make, and the warrant is issued for not showing up once. Mm-hmm. And so it's I think the general public doesn't have any idea of just how horribly over-controlled poor people's lives are, and especially poor people who would be labeled as criminals.
Wow. Oh, yeah, that is startling. I was kind of aware of the federal government's tendency mm-hmm. to want to build prisons to solve our social problems, but I didn't realize that the provinces were kind of tending that way as well.
And a few of the provinces have squawked and said that the Harper legislation, what is it? They kept calling that a different thing. It's the Truth in Sentencing and the omnibus bill, but mm-hmm. they're all omnibus bills now. Anyway, it was to mandatory minimums, mm-hmm. that they would cause a huge cost to the provinces. And only a couple of provinces have pointed this out to the federal government.
Yeah, I think the province of Quebec was the most vocal.
Yeah, well, yeah. Good on them. I mean, they yeah. got childcare, for heaven's sakes. But so they must be, whatever Quebec's doing, I take my hat off to them.
Yeah.
But my suspicion is that they are getting money, or they will get money, because mm-hmm. the prison building programs that are going on now are substantial and very costly, and the kinds of places they're building are much modeled on these sort of SHU units, maximum mm-hmm. security remand. There's a 2,000 cell remand unit in Edmonton, and I didn't know about it until I saw an ad for the 400 employee spots mm-hmm. that would be hired to run that place. And you just have to ask yourself, at what point would Edmonton need 2,000 people to be awaiting trial and remand? I mean, they have a plan, you mm-hmm. know?
it's kind of strange, because Edmonton is one of the few places in Canada that's doing something constructive to look after homelessness.
Well, we often put on our pictures of jails, new homes for the poor. If it's privately run, mm-hmm. and this is what you'll see in the United States system, they start to sell, you know, they rent out cells in another province to right. another province. So if Manitoba gets too full, they'll send them up to Edmonton. This constant movement of people is part of the way of really creating super isolation for prisoners as well, and people can't visit them when they're in another place. And you'll see this in the States, where mm-hmm. Texas has overbuilt jails, or Ohio is sending, you know what I mean? They're all sending, swapping prisoners who are mostly still in jail for mm-hmm. being poor and having these really weird, crappy charges that shouldn't exist.
And I wonder how many of these jails are actually owned by corporations.
They are. And mm-hmm. that's the one in Surrey is owned by Brookfield, who... owns Zaccone Park. But Brookfield's already running the 10 prisons in British Columbia in terms of the running of them. They sign a contract with the BCGEU, And we've gone to the unions to say, you guys need to talk to us, you know, about what's going on. But the new prison is going to be built, owned, and run by Brookfield. And we think that Ellis Dawn, a big corporation, is building the $1 billion facility in Toronto. And again, a remand center, maximum security. See, remands are where you're held before trial. Mm-hmm. So the idea, there's a sort of fundamental principle of justice that people really shouldn't do a lot of hard time before they've been found guilty.
Right.
But they're quite emboldened. And I don't think enough people are speaking out against it or working to get this into the dominant discussion. Mm-hmm. We think we were successful at Bandu was to get the public to understand the situation that drug users were facing with overdoses and lack of housing, and they couldn't get doctors and they were being turned away from Emerge, and the huge number of overdoses followed by a terrible outbreak of HIV.
Yeah.
And I think that if you want to lose a city election in Vancouver, say you're against harm reduction and you'll lose. So that's a real, you know, you can see how this powerless group of people in a sense can start to raise awareness. And that's one of the great things about powerless people, is that they don't have a lot to lose necessarily. Mm-hmm. So we're able to do a fair amount of civil disobedience with setting up of unsanctioned injection sites and crack smoking areas, so that we can at least get people off the street. And all the research will show that people soften in those situations. They are able to stop being in such a complete panic all the time, that they have nowhere to sleep that night. They're main goal is just to get some more money to do some more drugs and get some more money and do some more drugs. And that can be interrupted by something like a Vandu meeting where we're going to be discussing, I don't know, preventing disease, safe injection, what to do if you see an overdose, your rights when the police talk to you, you know, some of the interest, and then what's going on in other countries where drug users have managed to create more citizenship for themselves, a sense of entitlement, or that they're viewed as people with disabilities and a diagnosable illness with a treatment. So those are the shifts that I think are they're the most humble, but they also create a really profound change.
I'm just wondering, with the RCMP, they've got themselves, I think, a pretty black eye in BC over the years with Robert Jakansky and tasering and that sort of thing. And in addition to that, of course, Robert Picton and the lack of following up simple leads that would have brought the whole thing to an end much sooner. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if any fallout from the study of what went wrong, whether that how that is affecting the way the police treat poor and disadvantaged people and drug addicts and that sort of thing.
Well, there's certainly no teeth in the report, but he does mention warrants, which is what I've been talking about. That's when you don't show up at court, there's a warrant for your arrest. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear that marginalized women with warrants are not going to turn to the police for help. It's never a good day to go say, oh, I have a warrant, because they're going to put you in a maximum security remand to await trial. And there you may kick a drug habit. They're incredibly horrible places to be, you know, just cement cells where you're out an hour or two a day. And it's just, you know, people use a kind of more middle-class notion. Why don't you go handle your warrants? And you go, I think we should graphically describe what this would be. Mm-hmm. And so then you start to see that those women, of course, if other people find out they have warrants, can really be a predator towards that woman and say, oh, well, I'll bring you your drugs. Oh, and oh, by the way, you owe me now, so I'm going to send this guy in. You can do some sexual favors and that'll be payment. And, you know, you get this captured, super isolated, super vulnerable group of women. So nothing, the problem we have is there's no accountability between the police and the public. Mm-hmm. And at least when I first moved to the downtown east side in 1993, there were regular community meetings with the police, and they would just simply release the numbers. It was one murder, no murders, this many raves. You know what I mean? They just gave you the little thing, and it was very helpful, and there was a general discussion, and that was it. Now, you can't even get the data without doing a Freedom of Information request, and even then, it's all this mudslinging and hostility. Mm-hmm. So we were trying to get the number of vending tickets. So they said, well, there's just been, you know, 43 in the last 4 years, and we're thinking, I know people with 43 just themselves. Mm-hmm. So then it turned out it was a technical thing. There's a vending ticket, and then there's displaying merchandise on the sidewalk. So what really is true about policing now is it's mm-hmm. It's an aggressive tricking of the public. They have their own PR departments. Mm-hmm. They're constantly misconstruing the danger that the public is in. They're constantly heightening their tremendous value. They're hiding the fact that, for the most part, they harass and sort of torture. I mean, mm-hmm. Very poor, marginalized people. People that they would be afraid to touch without putting gloves on. And that, rather than this sort of heroic cop portrayed on a television show who's mm-hmm. busting a kingpin drug dealer, they're likely to be standing in a filth strewn alley harassing some woman who has a warrant for mm-hmm. An old sex a prostitution charge, and then claiming to us they aren't charging for prostitution. So it's all, and they have now, as things get more and more sophisticated in their records, mm-hmm. they'll never let it go. That mm-hmm. puddle of debt for that jaywalking ticket will follow you to the end of time. Mm-hmm. And this is a really depressing and horrible situation. We were at first, you know, with my usual kind of middle-class vigor, I go, well, we can handle that. We'll go to court for every single ticket. And then yep. we started to realize how mm-hmm. bizarre the ticket system was, where they wouldn't give you the court date. It would have to be mailed to you. Mm-hmm. If you're not quick enough with your SkyTrain or bus, you didn't have proof of fare ticket, riding without fare, it's an automatic declaration of guilt if you're not there within less than 30 days.
Oh, okay.
Which, of course, is... it violates our sense of a fundamental principle of justice that mm-hmm. because you didn't show up, you've now declared you've pleaded guilty.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm saying, you know, there's people who are impaired, like in terms of being mentally ill mm-hmm. or just, you know, and they might even own a bus pass and not have had it with them that day. Like, and now they're going to private collection agencies. It's just it's very, very large, mm-hmm. but it's all done at this horrible level. So we're not seeing, we used to at least, they had a lot of drug charges. They still do have quite a few, mm-hmm. but the classic was the cops came up and bought drugs off you with this new Hollywood North makeup. And the classic is to have a woman with a cold sore on her mouth, which keeps distracting you. But she pulls out a 20, mm-hmm. you know, a nice crisp 20. So yeah. I started putting up warning signs if someone, because they weren't even going to dealers, they were just going to other drug addicts and saying, can you help me score? And then mm-hmm. doing this, I'm really sick, you gotta help me. Yeah. You know, and this sort of acting award kind of stuff. And then if they, I don't have any drugs. I mean, of course they didn't have any drugs or addicts. That's a problem with addicts. They never have any drugs. Mm-hmm. So they weren't dealers. And then they'd say, oh, take me to your dealer. And then the two of them would be chokeholds. And you'd find out it was an undercover cop who just nailed you. So mm-hmm. we were putting out mm-hmm. warning.
Yeah.
If it's too good to be true. And the place where it's too big to be true is the money. That's mm-hmm. the lure. Because what the tradition is if you help someone score drugs, they'll give you a little bit of the drug as a, you know, as a commission or something.
Yeah.
So, and now you're charged with trafficking, mm-hmm. not even that you touch drugs, just because you said that guy's selling. Mm-hmm. And then the dealer, of course, is now like glaring at you like you're in trouble because mm-hmm. you just got him busted.
Right.
And so it's just an awful mess, and all this violence breaks out. I mean, what we're saying is that we would all just sit down and say, we know that we can prescribe drugs to these addicts. Mm-hmm. We can shut down the black market mm-hmm. or incredibly highly impact it. If there was a black market for alcohol, when alcohol was made legal, let's say it was almost wiped out. Mm-hmm. And we know that we can, it's much cheaper to say to someone, look, if you're HIV positive, can I offer you a decent apartment? And I will come every week. Tell me what you need. Please mm-hmm. don't ever do another sexual act for mm-hmm. money. Okay. Right. What do you need so that doesn't ever occur?
Right.
And, you know, these are rational, normal Canadian kind of things to do. And yet the police will not talk to us about that. It's like, ooh, mm-hmm. no community meetings for us. We're not discussing it. Or we're obligated to enforce the criminal code, blah, blah, blah. And then they just drone on and on. And then you start to say, who's really in on this? Mm-hmm. Then, you know, there's a kind of clearing of a piece of land that people want to speculate on and develop. There's a lot of factors at work, but follow the money. If you want to know why everything's stuck the way it's stuck, follow the money. And it can come down to being as petty as police officers getting overtime pay for doing more and more police activity in terms of the tickets they're giving out or the arrests for petty crime that they're making. They really will get overtime. And they can also then add at, it makes them have a higher status as being an active member who's producing, and they can get advancement.
I'm kind of surprised, you know, at this sort of lack of improvement in the attitude of the police. I remember seeing a video, somebody videoed a cop just pushing, I think somebody who was basically handicapped on the sidewalk, just sort of knocking them out of the way. One of those.
That's a famous case, and Pivot took that case on, The you know, at some point you just want to say, if this is his second or third offense like this, that he's just not police material and that we need, they have, there's a, actually a really shameful, horrible thing that happened last year, and that's that the police are going around with cameras and we've been trying to get them to stop filming, and I couldn't get them to stop. Me and my friends couldn't get them to stop. It's pretty surprising. And we keep saying to the city, we know you guys are crazy about liability, so who's in on this? Why are you letting this occur? And it's not a documentary. That's what the police keep saying, or the city keeps saying, it's a documentary. And that they, you know, that it's like a news team. You just have to leave them alone. I said, no, they're not. They're out of the top of a car and they're getting shots, and then they'll arrest someone and then bring another officer from away to try and keep continuity with their story if they show him doing the arrest, even though he didn't make the arrest. So they're, that's beef. That's bullshit. You know what I mean? Like, you're laying, you're, the guy's sitting there with his handcuffs on for God knows what stupid non-crime, and they have to bring over another guy because they're trying to feature him in the bit. So it's not, it's like a docudrama. So some of it is obviously real, but they keep beefing up the story one way or other. And it's on the internet, and it's called The Beat. And if you ever watch it, it says, the most dangerous neighborhood in North America. And I just think, guys, calm down.
On that note, let's take a break.
Okay.
And we'll be back after this. We're back with Anne Livingston from Vancouver, the Vancouver.
It's the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users.
Right.
VANDU.
VANDU.
Yeah, everyone calls it VANDU.
And you're a volunteer with that.
Yeah, I was a co-founder, and I was the executive director for, say, 10 years. And then I just worry that things will become too Anne Livingston-ish. And it's important that a group can move forward. I mean, to last for 10 years was surprising enough. And you need people who can carry on. And,
With any group like that, you need renewal.
I think so. That's what I thought.
And
so,
we all get older.
So. Yeah, I mean, you got your blind spots, you know.
So,
it was an interesting, and what it did is it freed me to become a volunteer in organizing users in Surrey and in Abbotsford and things. What a sorry mess. It's a terrible problems they're having.
I'm really, I don't know, startled, dismayed, disappointed, whatever, with the way the police are sort of reacting to, again, the Picton inquiry and that sort of thing. I know that there is a certain amount of pressure for, like, they think that Greater Vancouver would be better served by one police service. You know, and that may be true.
Well, I went to the workshops. I went, I participated in the Missing Women's Commission of Inquiry, and it was unusual. But what was really unusual was because they wouldn't give us, they gave us standing, but then we couldn't get a lawyer. So I got to cross-examine police officers. I only wish that I had more support, because you could really cause. I completely disagreed with the community's approach, which was to boycott, because they think they're getting another inquiry, and I don't. And I also have a sister-in-law who's one of the missing, and I reported her repeatedly and could not even get the police to take the report. So I have this, I don't know. Anyway, and a lot of the women were members of our organization, and it goes back a long way. So I think a lot of them are new. I don't know why they think that's a successful strategy. My strategy would have been for everyone who wasn't getting a lawyer to just play lawyer. They have to let you at the front. You get to sit with all the other lawyers. You get to cross-examine any one of the witnesses, and you're not a lawyer. Now, imagine that.
Man.
And then have the place full every day of people watching these.
Now, were you not allowed to get a lawyer? Or
we were allowed, but we didn't have one, so therefore I was just sitting up there with all the lawyers. They were still really weird. They wouldn't let me see any documents, so they were constantly referring me to another lawyer who was appointed to represent the public or the downtown east side, which was an awkward thing. His report, though, is very good. It's called "They Wouldn't Piss on Them If They Were on Fire." It's worth reading. It's a quote directly from a police officer who was investigating the missing women, who's, I believe, a lesbian and is somewhat isolated herself, but was left with one officer investigating all these missing women. And anyway, that was the quote from her, was how interested were the police in these missing women? They wouldn't piss on them if they were on fire, was her quote. It's a little unusual
volumes.
Turn of phrase. It's not one that I use, but it's... that's the title of his paper, is because of that. So it's very condemning. It's much more difficult to read Cameron Ward's report. But if there's a lack of sincerity somewhere, you could always take people to the police at the level of the organization. Individual officers probably can be okay or not okay.
Sure.
The discussion around getting the metro or mega police for the whole Lower Mainland or for many of the municipalities. I went to that thing and just listened. And finally, I just put up my hand and I said, I don't think it's about the size of it. If they're not accountable, you could have really crappy, you know, metro area police, and you could have very good localized police. I don't think the quality of policing lies in the
size,
in the structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it lies in that they're not accountable and there is no citizen input. So... And in some places, there obviously is. You'll find these pockets of policing where there's not this kind of hostility and strangeness going on. But I think the police culture is very networked all across the world, and any place that's seen to have police who aren't going with this very militaristic model, treating everyone like they're shooting people with knives. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, you're very. Much more likely to be shot by a police than anyone else, I think.
Yeah, well, and it's in this province now. Of course, they've gone back to the taser with much more control. You know, the situations in which they can use it, I think, are more defined and more stringent. Where before, if they felt like it, they would use it.
Well, you know, they always just go get someone who can talk to the person. I mean, I supposedly work with these terribly dangerous people, but we have very little violence at Vandu because there's a sense that if they disagree with something, they can appeal that decision. Mm-hmm. And they have a number of, you know, and if that doesn't work, they still have more ways to go at it. So you don't get this sort of subversive violence. And I think some of the other medical facilities do. They get, you know, people are the med police and they check if you're not on your meds, then they'll hospitalize you. Or so, you know, we have a very different relationship. The drug users run the drug user organization, so it's based on we have non-voting members who have never been drug addicts, and voting members are people who are currently or have been in the past.
I noticed that was an interesting part. That's in your constitution or your bylaws that if you haven't used drugs or you aren't using drugs, then you can't vote.
Yeah, and we don't do it. You can be, people go on and off drugs all the time. So it's a chronic recurring kind of thing. You know what I mean? People are, so we don't, the experience of using drugs is something that I think is profound, and they will have the ability to act in the best interest of drug users where outsiders don't. And I know they always think they have because we're all so smart, but.
Yeah.
It's a very, I think working at Vandu has been a really interesting experience because, you know, in theory, democracy is often embraced, but in practice, it's not often practiced. So we actually practice it.
Right.
And then you get really stuck in oddball situations where they'll pull things off and you're only, you know, I learned all kinds of different impulses rather than making more rules and making things more restrictive or barring more people. What they do is they just keep saying this is on a incident by incident basis. So one of the it's almost a spiritual quality of Vandu is inclusion. They just feel that since they've all been treated so terribly, they don't think that the drug user group can be the group that says you're barred for life.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unusual to have anything that severe ever happen. So it's always lots and lots of more chances, because I guess the concern would be, what if they died or something? You know what I mean? This is a Conrad. This is a fellow member, you know. So I think the lessons are if I brought skill to it, it was to constantly keep refocusing on the mission statement. So it's always read out at every meeting. Every meeting ends with a moment of silence, because that's the tradition they took in because of the large numbers of people who have died. We think that 3,000 people, 4,000 people have died in our neighborhood in 10 years. It's a tremendously high number of people.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more if you look at all the other causes. But nonetheless, I mean, this is a group of people that need to constantly remind themselves that the work they're doing has a purpose other than getting more drugs and partying or something, you know. So it has a different – it's not that people don't think or say those things. It's that it refocuses the actions and the – understanding of, you know, to improve the lives of people who use illegal drugs. So.
Well, Vandu basically started off as a needle exchange site, did it not?
No, it actually started off as a program that would reduce hospitalizations. So somebody was doing these determinants of health, and actually the beginning of the NDP government, they did a lot of this work. And because the healthcare dollars are just massive. I don't know if it's happening here. They're almost swallowing half of the budget of British Columbia government.
I think it's similar here. Yeah.
And there's huge amounts of waste, and we know what the wastes are. If people get sick enough for acute care, that's very, very costly.
Yeah.
And hospitalizations are very, very costly. So someone said, let's set aside 0.3 or 0.1. I don't know, whatever it is. It was a very humble sounding percentage.
Yeah.
But because the number's so large, it was a few million dollars. And then these little community groups were able to apply to say, show us how your group is going to keep people from being hospitalized.
Oh, okay.
And then we were turned into an HIV prevention service. And, of course, we demanded a decentralization of needle exchange. We knew that people were coming from all over the Lower Mainland to one needle exchange, which was exchanging in the millions and millions of needles. And we demanded an end of needle exchange, because it started to become more and more obvious that unless people can get the number of syringes they need, things change. So if there's a ton of powder cocaine around and people are getting eight balls and all their friends are there, they're going to need a lot of syringes. And, you know, teaching people tricks like if you're at a cocaine party and you're injecting, then you should label your syringes so nobody, you know, and no one mixes anything up. And then anyway, so some of that stuff we were it's obviously practical stuff. And we were able to work with researchers. And I think that's been the real – some researchers were terrible and we learned a lot and then made sort of the rules of engagement with a researcher. You think you can exploit this group, get lost.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've had incidents where we did a project with them and they take all the data. And we say, it's not your data, it's our data. That's in our agreement. So now we've really laid it out clearly. So, you know, it's always, it's been fairly good. We do a lot of civil disobedience, and that's why the topic of the speak was about that, because I think that people often don't grasp what I mean. And Morgenthaler doing abortions when they were illegal is the most obvious case, because it really is complicated to do. It's a very medical procedure where running an injection site is still considered a health service. So running an injection site is very low tech, but there are things you need to know how to do. You need to know how to revive someone who's overdosed. You need to know that the way you've laid it out isn't going to cause harm to anyone, in the sense of, you know, you're going to, so it's a, I mean, they're calling inside a clinic. We wouldn't call our guerrilla exchange a clinic, because we don't have medical personnel on. But we, at every chance, try and make sure that there's Narcan for overdoses and that people are trained in CPR, and then sort of de-escalating violent situations, on and on like that. So it's...
So you're not doing needle exchange anymore?
No, we actually... Well, we do. See, what happened in Vancouver was every possible place became a needle exchange. So our needle exchange works like that. Someone will come in and say, can I have some needles? And I'll say, over there in a shelf, just help yourself.
Right.
And sometimes we have a worker sitting there because we have a volunteer system where we like to test people out a little before we leave them in charge of the building. So they'll be sitting there, and what they'll write down is not oh, you know, Joe has taken 10 syringes and returned 15. Mm-hmm. We don't do it that way. Tracking, right. Individual tracking, which, yeah, a lot of needle exchanges have been addicted to doing. We're trying to say, drop that. Mm-hmm. If you want data, keep data that maybe you want to know how many people, just have check boxes, male, female, and then the number in, the number out. And you can start to have a sense of how you're doing, mm-hmm, without saying to people, I've given you 50 syringes and you didn't bring back any. Why should I give you any more? And I'm thinking, mm-hmm, because you're funded to stop the spread of HIV,
yeah,
people, yeah, who don't bring dirty syringes back are the most marginalized users you can find, mm-hmm, the most likely to have HIV already, the most likely to share with someone else who's just as marginalized, and keep this damn epidemic going. So please use your heads on this. Mm-hmm. And this is a fight that we're having with needle exchanges throughout the province in British Columbia, because people will adopt these things and not realize that it's time to move forward.
So the public health aspect of this is the one, it's one of the main drivers.
Yes. And ensuring, I mean, needle exchange was illegal. And in many ways, needle exchange is still illegal. The trace amount of drugs in a syringe would, mm-hmm, get you even years in jail in the day. Mm-hmm. And if they still want to really harass someone, they could do that. They could take someone to court for that. But we've got people sitting around with buckets and buckets of used syringes around them, and no one seems to care anymore. Mm-hmm. And no MOU was written, no law was changed, nothing happened. So I have the same sort of premise about injection sites. I think that it's a low-tech thing. You don't want to see what's high-tech? You try and get some heroin, keep, mm-hmm, it somewhere, and be dosing people with heroin. Now, that's something where you're going to need some medical expertise, some medical, you know, that's a complicated program.
Is that something that's done?
Yeah,
now?
In Vancouver, we had the NAOMI study, which is the North American Opiate Maintenance Initiative. Now we have Salome, and I can't tell you what it means.
Okay.
But it means something. And people are being prescribed heroin, mm-hmm, and comparing it to how well they do on Dilaudid. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to create a kind of patient's rights case that they can't be dropped from this study, mm-hmm, because it's unethical to do it. You wouldn't do it for cancer, right? Mm-hmm. Someone's really responding well. Nothing's gone so well. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the study's over. Yeah, I'll take those, right, cancer, yeah, drug back. Go back to the one that didn't work for you before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're trying to say we want drug users treated with the same respect of anyone who would be participating in one of these kinds of studies. So that's the hope as we see, yeah, people just now coming off of Salome. It's a very staggered program. They'll end up with 100 and something people, but they're only taking them as 30 come off, 30 go on, because, mm-hmm, they only have a certain amount of capacity.
My understanding, my limited understanding, mm-hmm, is that careful heroin maintenance is much better than methadone.
Yes, that's what I think there's a lot of evidence to back that up. And some people don't like heroin maintenance because you have to go back so many times. But, mm-hmm, interestingly, they're using this oral heroin that no one, or I've certainly never heard of, and I've been at this a while. Anyway, mm-hmm, so the shock being that the abstinence rates for heroin are very, very high, where people have a lot of trouble getting off of methadone. Mm-hmm. And I meet a few people, mm-hmm, and they'll say, I was on methadone and I weaned off and got off. Mm-hmm. Other people have so much trouble getting down, then they go back up, then they go back down. And it tends to be such a corruptly, horribly run program that, you know, I think that's one of the difficulties with it. The other thing is, if people really want heroin and they do poorly on methadone, then they get the heroin. That's what they wanted. And the other fear of, you know, if you do have the courage to wean off and try life without drugs, mm-hmm, which takes courage, mm-hmm, if you relapse, you might be able to go back onto the heroin program. That takes a huge amount of pressure off of people, because people go, why don't they just quit? But they themselves can't miss their morning cup of coffee. You know what I mean? Yeah. They'd be in bed, mm-hmm, for 2 days with a headache if they, yeah, didn't have their coffee.
And if they're
so
smokers.
We have these terrible biases, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, where, why don't they just quit? Like, I don't know. Why are you using just in that sentence, for, mm-hmm, heaven's sakes? So there's a tremendous Hollywood bias, brainwashing, and a hatred of drug addicts. It's, you know, every Rockford Files, every, mm-hmm, Adam 12, I don't know, name any damn show. Yeah. They'll always show this horrible, sleazy snitch who's sniveling and sells, yeah, out, yeah, his mother. You know what I mean? It's just, mm-hmm, awful.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be said that really does influence drug users' behavior. So this whole new image of someone who's involved in a user group, who, mm-hmm, speaks publicly, who's in doing, gets their name on papers. So one of the beauties of VANDU is to have worked well with researchers, so that when we're doing civil disobedience, like we are, mm-hmm, in our office right now, we have an injection room and a and a place to smoke crack. Mm-hmm. We have, I can't remember what his study is, but his field is, but I have, a, I don't know if it's got to be, it's the title he's calling it is Social, Structural, and Spatial Factors Shaping Access to an Unsanctioned Peer Run Supervised Drug Consumption Facility.
Ooh, that's quite the mouthful.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, I don't know if it was an academic here, they go, oh, I spot that language. But I think it might be ethnography or anthropology or geography. I'm not sure what he's studying. But it's interesting to have him there because what we put people in the position where the, if the police are going to come into Vandu and charge people and say, look, you're running a site here.
Yeah.
You don't have an exemption. You don't have a license to do this. This is clearly, you know. What would they charge people with? I mean, they're going to go after the addicts who actually possess drugs on site.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they would do anyway if they were in the alley.
Right.
But the beauty of them being in our place is if they do overdose, someone's there to save them. And they're in a clean environment. They can calm down and do what they're doing. And it's a teaching moment for anyone who sees them making mistakes. So the we're not sure why we're not shut down, but one of the things is if you are, you have a paper to go to court with showing that you're making every effort so that there's a kind of ethical obligation to act to save your neighbor's lives rather than to, you know, just do this, you know, just be oblivious.
Yeah. Well, one thing I noticed in British Columbia is there seems to be some understanding of what you're trying to achieve at some higher levels.
Yes, and I think that we've won over the public. If you want to lose a civic election and not be mayor of Vancouver, say you're against injection site or say you're against harm reduction.
Right.
That'll work like a charm. Because I think people view themselves, and I think Canadians view themselves. Now, whether this is, I just haven't been to the regions of Canada that voted for Harper, I just don't know. But they view themselves as people who know that one of the ways they're not American or one of the ways they're really Canadian is they have a sense of rolling up your sleeves to tackle social problems. They don't want to be constantly embarrassed about letting so many people die for no reason, even though we could have done something, that we've got a healthcare system that's inclusive. I mean, the Aboriginal, the treatment of Aboriginal people, I think, is a terrible wound to most Canadians, and they would like to move forward with it. And, you know, they, I don't think the government will, but, and who, you know what I mean? There's, I think that not enough is done at that level to say what kind of education and discourse. And once a discourse, you know, there was a time if I was at a cocktail party, which I was probably never invited back. But if you started to talk about injection sites and heroin prescription, it's like a dome went around you. Like no one would come and talk to you because it was a very marginalized kind of discussion. But I think more and more people are thinking these things or chatting about them around the, you know, so that's the task at hand is to get people to start understanding the whole system and, you know, could we get these other programs in place and do Canadians really value prisons and police and helicopters and, you know, all of that's coming down on us or do we really have a sense of, you know, soccer games and swimming pools and, you know, university that kids can afford? I don't know. Maybe I'm reading people wrong, but and, you know, the longer we go without that, it's going to fade from people's minds. But
I'm just wondering here, now maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I see in BC some momentum building, you know, a direction that, that society seems to be going in that's very positive and very helpful in terms of the harm reduction and doing something about persons who are addicted and trying to do something about that. And I'm wondering if you think that the momentum that seems to be building in BC can spread through the rest of the country.
Well, I think it depends. You know, the health authority, you know, itself is, you know, got the, to us, they seem like they have infinitely large budgets. Vandu's funded at less than what an average physician makes. We get $200,000 a year. I clearly pay for less than one AIDS case. You know what I mean? And, and then the public gets, oh, you're funding that drug user group. They get all that money. I'm thinking, But anyway, the I think that people need to see the cost of not doing it. And I think we need to have these public education campaigns. At one point, we did get the old health authority to do at least one of the flyers that goes door to door and one of those newspapers that gets delivered door to door. And why not? They do it on diabetes. You know, I'd sort of challenge them and say, I see you're doing public education around depression or diabetes. Like, they have topics. So this one clearly is impacting. We think that as many as one in four children are growing up in a household with an addicted person in that household. That's really high. Yeah. And those are the kids that are vulnerable. We think that if children have parents that go to jail, as we're seeing these incarceration programs come in, a predictor of whether you're going to jail as a child is whether your parents went to jail. And that's what there's a lot of movement in the states to get the black communities to really embrace this and say the drug problem needs to be embraced as a, you know, racist law enforcement. So Michelle Alexander is, you know, written the new Jim Crow, and she's talking about this underclass of people. And the problem with an underclass is that everybody else never has any contact with them. That's the problem. You might be, you know, a union prison guard, and that's your contact with them. Or you might be a, the police, by the way, are paid very high wages, in my opinion. They're paid more than school teachers, as far as I can see. In Vancouver, we probably have 1,000 cops that are making over $100,000 a year. That's a tremendous amount of money, in my opinion. They don't have to get a degree to become a police officer. And it's one of the ways they keep people really obedient and this whole thing going.
It seems to me that, like so many of our other social issues, that you need to create awareness. And you have to educate, and that's where you start. And if you can do that, well, then you can get some traction and get people to realize what is the proper direction or what's a reasonable direction to go to solve a problem.
And it, the as activists, sometimes we disengage and want to speak on behalf of. The most important thing to do first, no matter what the problem is make sure that you've got the drug users organized. So it's been a, it's fairly inexpensive. We're going out to Surrey and holding two meetings a month, and I will actually give them each $5 for coming to the meeting. And if you look at the amount of money that is, it's way under $10,000 to have a fairly robust group of people organized to meet twice a month. And that means that things can occur between those meetings where, oh, let's all go to City Hall. Oh, let's all go over here. Like that they can really, as those issues pop up, be able to react to them quickly and then take a longer term view. Are you going to be able to apply for a scholarship to go to the International Harm Reduction conference? We have had members go to India to, I mean, these are life-changing events for people. As in, and you go from being, you know, this hated, huddled individual to somebody who's going to speak articulately about their life in a broader context for the politics of it, the how the international drug trade's working, how, you know what I mean? There's a place where they're situated where it's not boring and it's not bad. It's a place that, I that's what I think. I think that, people can start to change who they see themselves as, and it will spread through a population, and they will have more self-care, and we will have less social problems with that group of people. And they will be able to speak directly about their lives and what can work. You know, why does heroin prescription have such a high rate of abstinence? Those kind of things.
We're just about out of time here. I'd like to finish off with one thing. I'm going to ask you, the average person listening to us right now, what do you think they can do to sort of do their part?
Well, I think they need to look at the budgets, whether it's their local city budget, their provincial budget, and bring it up in political arenas. We have not had the NDP in British Columbia embrace this issue. We have not had the BCGEU, the Government Employees Union, say, yes, we're the guards and we are concerned. There's no dialogue taking place at that level. And the danger, I think their fear, or they're being handled by these awful PR people, are saying, oh, don't say anything. No, say something, because it could be your kid next, and don't ever think it couldn't be. That's hubris before the fall. And we need this dialogue to be not one about being soft on crime, but being smart about how we deal with social problems.
Thanks very much, Anne Livingston. It's been a really interesting experience talking to you about your experiences with VANDU.
Thank you.
As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m., Amnesty Letter Writing, Atlantis Coffee, is at Victoria Avenue and Hamilton Street. Several Amnesty members will be present writing current Amnesty International appeals. Please feel welcome to join them for some letter writing. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."